Amy Stewart has been a guest on Through the Eyes of Women twice before. Today, she joins me, Kathleen Marshall, for her third and probably not last interview with us. To listen to the previous interviews, visit the Through the Eyes of Women blog at www.khsuwomen.wordpress.com. On the right side, under categories, click on Amy Stewart. In addition to talking about the fourth in the Cop Sisters series, Amy has an exciting announcement about that series. That's coming up next on Through the Eyes of Women. Stay tuned. Welcome to Through the Eyes of Women, a program for, by, and about women concerning the lives and perspectives of women, local, national, and international. Amy, this is, by the way, your third time as a guest on the show, so welcome back.
Thank you.
From the previous two interviews, these are the things I know. You graduated from the University of Texas at Austin. You earned a master's degree in city planning. You have an altruistic streak, having worked in rape crisis. You wrote your first book, a memoir of working in your garden in Santa Cruz in your spare time while working full-time. You've got six nonfiction books under your belt and a growing reputation as a fiction writer. And you sit down and write 1,000 words every day.
Well, not every day. When I'm home and working, I do a minimum of 1,000 words a day, but that's not 365 days a year. Those are just the months when I'm writing. Starting in November, I try to be home and starting my next book. And so that goes through sometime in February or March. And then the rest of the year, I'm sort of in editing and rewriting mode, but that's in between traveling and, you know, other things.
Okay, so I heard a story today about your decision to write fiction rather than continue your nonfiction botany series. How did that happen?
Well, I had been wanting to write fiction for a while. In between some of my nonfiction books, I have novels that nobody wanted to publish. So there's already two or three failed novels in drawers that I wrote in earlier years. And so I had kind of made up my mind that after Drunken Botanist, I was definitely going to write another novel. And I ran across this story, a true story in the newspaper from 1914 about the Cop Sisters. And I was just fascinated. So I decided right away that I had to tell their story and that it would not be one book, but several books. So I knew from the get-go, like, if I do this, this is a series.
Are you completely done with nonfiction at this point in your career then, do you think?
Well, I don't know what I'll do after I'm finished with this, because I have many more books to write about the cops. So it's the question of what I'm going to do after I'm done with that is sort of a what are you going to do in 5 or 10 years question. And I don't know.
That's a really good answer. I don't know what I'm going to be doing in 5 or 10 years either.
And if you thought you knew, you'd be wrong. So that's the point.
Exactly. You started writing your current book that's just recently been released, Miss Cop Just Won't Quit. You started writing that in November of 2016, when our nation was reeling from the 2016 presidential election. Now, in Miss Cop Just Won't Quit, that also takes place during an election cycle that could turn Constance Cop's world upside down.
Right. Well, I mean, of course I knew that the next book was going to take place during the 1916 election, because that's just chronologically what was happening next in Constance's real life. And let me just say, so she's a deputy sheriff. It's 1914. This is all true. This really happened. And this was very early for a woman to have a role in law enforcement like this. So she was really sort of a pioneering woman in law enforcement. And her boss is the sheriff, and that's an elected position, as it is, you know, everywhere. So, and he was termed out, so he was not going to be able to run for sheriff again. She was going to have a new boss either way. So I knew that was the story, but the first day that I had free to start working on that book was literally the day after the 2016 election. That just happened to be my first available day. And I thought, well, I'll be so hungover from my Hillary victory party, you know, that it's a weird day to start a book. But I thought, well, I might as well. So, of course, I woke up the next morning to a very different outcome than the one I'd been hoping for. And I think, like a lot of us, I was just trying to get through the day and get through the week. And, I thought, well, I should go ahead and work. I need to keep myself together. I need to eat regular meals and stick to a schedule. So I went upstairs to my office to start working on my next book, and I realized, oh, I'm writing a novel about a woman doing a man's job who's the target of vicious misogynist attacks during a very heated, politicized election season. So suddenly the whole book looked very different to me, you know? So there are definitely undertones. There are parallels between 1916 and 2016, and many of those are just real. They're just in the historic record. All the anti-immigrant rhetoric in 1916 was utterly real. But some of them are little kind of nods to the dynamics of the 2016 election. I saw possibilities there and used them a little bit. But I promise, if you read the book, you're not going to have to relive the pain of that election, because the book is about other things. Like, the election is happening in the background, but mostly Constance is doing her job.
Yes.
And she has cases to work on and things to do. And that's the book.
Yes. The book opens with Constance diving into the dirty river on a stormy day to rescue a convict. And rather than being hailed as a hero, she's ridiculed and criticized. Let's talk about that kind of misogyny.
Right. I mean, this happened to her all the time. You know, she did the same things that male officers did. And this is part of what made her so unusual. So most women working in law enforcement 100 years ago were really more like social workers. They were there to kind of help with the women and children who came through the system. But they weren't issued a gun and handcuffs and given arrest authority and all the obligations and responsibilities that male deputies had. And in fact, women who wanted into law enforcement had to keep going around assuring men, like, we don't want it. We don't want your job. No one's taking anything away from you. We want to do this other thing that needs to be done. So Constance was unusual in that she did have arrest authority and she did carry a gun and wore a badge and everything else. But when she did the work that her male colleagues were doing, it was seen very differently. For one thing, it was all over the newspapers in a way that it wasn't when the men did it. And very often her boss was criticized. You know, you should have never had a woman in that role. She's a terror. You know, during the election season, she was called a troublesome lady policeman and a demon deputy. So they were quite literally demonizing her. They used that word. So I think people were very offended at the idea of a woman out doing all this. And it seemed dangerous and it seemed maybe not in the public's interest. So it backfired on her. Every amazing thing she did came back to bite her in one way or another.
Yes. And, you know, it's also interesting in the stories that misogyny was actually internalized in women as well. So she took flack from both sides, male and female.
Yeah, I really wanted to show that because, you know, and of course, this is the time period when we don't yet have the vote, but we're going to get the vote in a few years. So suffragist movement was at a fever pitch right then as well. And there were women who did not want women to have the vote. And there were women who were very much on the side of women sticking to their traditional roles and in some cases saying things like, I don't want to be a man. I don't want the responsibilities and the obligations. And, you know, I don't want to be sent into war. I don't want to carry a gun. Like, this is not my nature. So those arguments were out there on both sides. And so I have characters in the novel who represent those perspectives as well and are very much trying to keep women's roles as they are and see that as a suitable division of labor and how a society ought to operate. So, yeah, all those arguments were really being made at that time.
Well, what about her sisters at this time? She has two sisters, Fleurette, who is young and flighty, and another sister, Norma, who is the oldest sister, I believe, and she is very serious and takes everything very seriously. How do you work with those kinds of contrasts to balance them and keep them real?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because, I couldn't have hoped for a better trio. You know, I've tracked down the family members. I've tracked down some descendants of the Kopp family. So what I know about their personalities comes in part from interviewing people who actually knew them or who had stories handed down from people who did know them. So Norma was in real life kind of a difficult, disagreeable woman. Sort of, she really knew how to hold a grudge. She was very judgmental. She was very certain of herself and her views and didn't want to entertain anyone else's views. So, I mean, I love that, right? Like, that's a lot of fun to work with.
I'll bet.
Yeah. And Florette, while nobody can really tell me about her personality as a teenager, you know, I know that she was kind of the little cute one. I mean, she really was a beautiful, petite creature who wanted to be on the stage. She wanted to sing and dance, and she was also extremely fashionable, and she made all her own clothes. She was a very talented seamstress. So, yeah, I have these two personalities that are kind of at opposite ends of a spectrum for Constance to play off against. I mean, Florette is a little more on the hyper-feminine side, and Norma is, you know, I mean, I have her as kind of something of an outdoors woman. You know, she's sort of the one who, if the chicken coop needs a new roof, she's up there on a ladder putting nail and shingles down and all everything that needs to be done.
Right. And Norma is also the one who keeps pigeons. So tell us a little bit about her storyline at this point when U.S. involvement in the First World War was looming. What was Norma doing?
Well, so here's the thing. In real life, I don't know what Norma was doing at all during this time period. She did a very good job of staying out of the papers. I don't even have a photograph of Norma from any time in her life. So Norma has to be fictionalized. In future books, I will know more about what Norma's up to. But for these books, I don't. So her interest in messenger pigeons is entirely fictional. I wanted to give her something that she cared about and that she was interested in, but I wanted it to be something that kind of like nobody else really appreciated. So I didn't want to give her like an adorable little dog or something like that. I wanted it to be something that her sisters were sort of horrified by. And it is true that messenger pigeons were used for communication at that time still, and they did have a role to play in World War I. So I thought that would, you know, be an interesting thing for me to research. And it is definitely one of those things that, you know, her sisters just completely don't get. And I kind of like that with siblings. You know, I like for there to be things that one just does not understand at all about the other. Like, how can you possibly be interested in this? I think that's a nice thing to have with siblings.
Do you have siblings?
I do. I have a brother.
And are you like that?
Yeah, you know, probably. I'm sure there are things that I'm into that he looks at and goes, yeah, I would never in a million years.
I don't have siblings, so I don't have that type of experience.
Yeah, sometimes we're just mystified by our siblings.
Well, the Kopp sisters do have another sibling. They have a brother. I think a very important element in all of these stories is that the sisters live independently. They live on their own when, in fact, society would prefer that as unmarried women with no men in the household, they would prefer that they live in their brother's household. Why do they not want to do that?
Well, you know, I'm speculating here about their real lives, but it is true that they lived independently for years and years and years as unmarried women. And I mean, who wouldn't want that, right?
Like, exactly.
You go live with one of your male relations and you're going to be put to work. you're going to be expected to do cooking and cleaning and sewing and taking care of the kids. And, you know, in those days, housework was so difficult. I mean, there were no washers and dryers. There were no vacuum cleaners. It was very physical, exhausting work. So for all those reasons, I'm sure they wanted to keep their independence, but it was almost impossible for women to do that at the time. Like, had they been renters, it would have been really tough for them to approach a landlord or a landlady as unmarried women and be able to rent rooms. I mean, even that was still kind of hard at that time.
It's important to note here, too, that in the books, the siblings were all raised by a very independent and strong-willed woman who was the matriarch of the family.
Yeah, I mean, so their mother is dead in the novels. In real life, she did live a few years longer, so I actually killed her off a little prematurely. Just because it was getting so complicated to have four women under one roof, as I'm sure it was in real life, but it was a lot for me to juggle. So I'm like, all right, someone has to go. Due to family circumstances, which, you know, you can read about in earlier books, I don't want to spoil too much, but for various reasons, they find themselves all living together under one roof.
Yes. And so speaking of their family, there is a family secret. And of course, as readers, we know what that secret is. At some point in this series, do you reveal to the characters involved, primarily Florette, because it's a secret about her, does she learn what that secret is at some point in this series?
Well, it's hard to answer that without giving too much away about what it is, but probably not. You know, the thing is, we all have things buried in our family history that we just learn to live with. I mean, if you think about it, these big dramatic moments, these big reveals where everyone suddenly finds out the truth, those are far and few between in real life. And I know it makes for good television or good reading. But I think in this particular case, in the particular circumstances, and I'm sorry if we're mystifying readers, but I think in this particular case, they kind of learned to live with reality the way it was.
I would say that a little bit of mystification for the readers is a good thing because they should be reading the book to find out the answers to those. You are listening to Through the Eyes of Women. I'm Kathleen Marshall. My guest today is Amy Stewart, talking about her fourth book of the Cop Sister series, Miss Cop Just Won't Quit. Amy, the last time I interviewed you, which was about the publication of the first in the series, I asked you to play a little game with me, and that was called the headline game. And I invented that little game because one of the things that Norma Cop does is she is an incessant newspaper reader, and she loves those headlines. So I'm going to quote a few headlines from 1916 newspapers, and I want you to tell me how you think Norma would use those headlines to make a point or manipulate her sisters.
Okay.
So the first headline is 5,000 citizens insulted.
That's great. This is what I love about headlines of the day. They are so good. You know, the thing about Norma is that she's really not easily insulted. She's actually quite tough, and so she's not fragile. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, she doesn't take offense in that sense of like, well, you've hurt my feelings, or that was insensitive of you. In fact, that's the very opposite of Norma. So I think she actually responds pretty well to people who are quite blunt, and it would just never occur to her to be insulted because she's quite sure of who she is, and there's just sort of no place for that in her worldview.
Right. It might mystify her that so many people could be insulted at once.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
So another headline I found was, Coast Guard ordered to get rid of sharks.
Get rid of sharks.
Doesn't that just pique your curiosity?
Oh, yeah. No, that's the thing. I mean, every headline from 100 years ago piques my curiosity. I remember when I first started working on these books, I kept wondering, like, why has no one written about them? How is it possible that no one knows this story? It's such an amazing story. And then I went to the Patterson Public Library and started going through the newspapers of the day. And I realized, like, oh, well, now I understand why no one remembers them. Like, everything in the paper 100 years ago was fascinating. there's 20 book ideas on the front page. I wanted to, you know, call up every writer I know and say, meet me at the Patterson Library. I've got your next novel here.
Exactly. I got to say, I really recommend it to our listeners to just do a Google search, you know, headlines from 1912 newspapers in the United States and just see what you get.
Right. They're really good.
Yeah, it's fun. So another one is divorce will not be fought. And there was a photograph of a woman, pretty unusual at that time, I would say.
Yeah, divorce will not be fought. Well, this was a time period when you could not just get a divorce. You had to go to a judge and persuade the judge of why you needed a divorce. And the judge could say no, and often did say no. And then you were just stuck being married to somebody you didn't want to be married to. So it really was a fight. Someone had to have done wrong, and the other person had to have been the person who was wrong.
Right. So I understand that there's something really exciting in the works for the Cop Sisters, and that is a series with Amazon.
Yeah. Amazon has the series under development. So they're, as I understand it, the writers are writing right now. And I know the writers. I met with them. I mean, they optioned the book several years ago, or all the books. So I met with them, and it's two women who are writing the show.
Oh,
and
great.
They're very talented screenwriters. They have done the last couple seasons of Veep. So if you're a fan of Veep, they're on that show. they seem to have good intentions, you know. I mean, I get no control or no say in what happens going forward, so I have to just make the best decision I can when I meet with the folks, and you know, they say all the right things, and so that's kind of the best I can do. So we'll see. I hope something does come of it. You know, even though it's in development, there's still a lot of stages, and things I'm sure can change at any point in the game. So I'll believe it when I see it.
Well, let's pretend that you do have some control. Who would be your ideal cast members?
Oh, yeah. So this is, and they actually ask you this question, and they take your answer seriously, no matter how crazy it is. So it's nice of them to at least ask. But my favorite person for Constance is Miranda Hart. She was on Call the Midwife.
Oh, yes.
She played Chummy in the first few seasons. Yes. I love Miranda Hart because she's big, for one thing, and Constance was 6 feet tall, weighed 180 pounds, which at that time was exceptionally large. The average height of a man was 5'7 or 5'8, so Constance would have seemed enormous to people at that time, at that size. So I like that Miranda Hart sort of carries herself. She's very comfortable in her own skin. She doesn't hunch over like tall women sometimes might do. You know, she seems very comfortable with her size, which I depict Constance that way. So I would love her. And I also think she has kind of the right look. Like, I don't want them to be too pretty. You know, I don't want them to be like Hollywood 2018 pretty. I want them to look like real people. And Miranda Hart, I think, strikes that balance very well. And for a long time, I couldn't figure out who would be a good Norma. I mean, I want someone who's a real sourpuss, you know? And so I kept thinking like, well, who's the 30-something version of Kathy Bates, for instance?
Yes.
You know, like, who is that? But I couldn't really think of anyone. But then I just went and saw Melissa McCarthy in this wonderful new movie she's in, Can You Ever Forgive Me? And she's perfect. I know she's a little older. I think she's in her late 40s, but I think she can play mid-30s.
And absolutely.
She's kind of grumpy and indomitable. You know, she has that. She's like a force for nature. And she's so good in this film. So, yeah, I would love her. And then I really don't have an idea for Florette, because Florette is young and cute. So to the extent that the TV people need somebody to be young and cute in the show, which they seem to always need that, Florette can be the young and cute one. So it's sort of just like, well, go pick someone. There's plenty of women like that in Hollywood.
And what about the primary male character, Sheriff Heath?
Yeah, Sheriff Heath is tough for me to imagine because I have real pictures of him. I mean, I have real pictures of a lot of them, but him in particular, it's very difficult for me to imagine anyone who doesn't look like the real pictures I have of him. I just would like it to be someone who isn't very well known for other parts, and also someone who looks like that era. You know, you wouldn't think that we look different now than we do 100 years ago. But do you know how, like, John Hamm on Mad Men, he just looks like the 50s?
Absolutely.
There's something about his face and his hair. They picked someone who just looks like that era. And so I want sort of the John Hamm actor, you know, the person who kind of looks like the 1910s and also who we don't have a ton of other associations with yet. Whoever that is.
Yes.
I don't know.
Yeah. Oh, wouldn't that have been fun if you could actually have chosen your own actors?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I know.
On the other hand, it's probably going to be a lot of fun watching how the series unfolds and who they do choose.
Right. Right. Well, and also just what changes. It's been interesting. I've talked to the writers a little bit about kind of the plots of the first few books and things that they can do in TV that I couldn't do in the book. They can develop storylines that are barely hinted at in the book, and they can really take them and do something with them. And I hope they do. I would love to see that happen.
That sounds great. So, you know, usually when you write, you also invent an alcoholic drink. So what's the drink for Miss Cop Just Won't Quit?
Oh, right. Yeah. I started doing these, a cocktail to go with each, only because I wrote a book about booze, The Drunk Botanist, and I found that people really show up at your events if you pour drinks. So that's why but mostly it's actually book clubs who do them. And for this one, there's a little scene between Constance and a lady lawyer, friend of Constance's, and a couple of male attorneys, and they're joking about a cocktail. So I used that as my inspiration. And it's basically, the drink is like a Moscow Mule. You know, it's a ginger ale type of drink, but it's got a little pineapple juice in it. It's just sort of like a fun, light drink that isn't really of the period at all, but it's something that... it's something that's basically just easy to mix if you're having friends over.
Did you name it?
I'm sorry. I'm blanking on the name right now. I'm sure it does have a name.
You know, it sounds like the kind of drink that if you're drinking it at a book club, it sounds pretty easy that it's going to go down and the book club members might need to spend the night.
I might have called it the Willful Deserter. I had a scene in the book has a little joke in it about cocktails being named after events in their lives, basically. You know, this was at a time period when cocktails were a brand new thing. And the idea of cocktails being named something funny was a sort of a strange new idea. And so it would have been something people might have joked about, like, what do we call this? So they were at a divorce lawyer's office. So willful deserter is a, you know, a charge that you can make against someone when they're getting divorced.
So what research do you do about this time period? What types of books do you have to read to really immerse yourself in the 1910s?
Well, it's been different for every book. So, for instance, in the new one, and Miss Cop Just Won't Quit, her main case that she's dealing with is a woman who's been put into an insane asylum. So there's been several good books written about women getting locked up during that time period for, you know, mental illness or what they at least thought was mental illness. And some of these tend to be people's PhD dissertations that then get published in a more kind of popular trade book format. So I have several of those. The previous one, Miss Cop's Midnight Confession, some of it took place in a girls' reformatory. And I got very lucky because there are several, again, these are basically dissertations, but good academic works where some researcher got hold of the entire archive of case files out of a girls' reformatory that had been closed, you know, 80 years ago.
Wow.
And they were able to go through and do deep case histories and really explain what was happening inside those reformatories. So those kind of books are good. I have one on my desk right now called Her Own Hero, which is a history of the women's self-defense movement. And that's just because in the fifth book, which I'm just kind of finishing up right now, Constance teaches some self-defense moves to some other women, and that's something that she would have known. She would have been taught how to throw a person down or how to fight somebody off or grab hold of someone.
Right, and she does that a number of times in each book.
Right. So I really wanted to know what, at that time period, what was known, like what did they call their self-defense moves, what was known about it, how did it work? So, yeah, I'll go, you know, find a book about that. And right now we're moving into World War One, so I'm reading a lot of war diaries and letter collections, particularly written by women who were serving in World War One.
And how many more books do you have planned for the series?
I really don't know, because we haven't even gotten to the 1920s yet, and they did so much in the 20s. So I could keep going for a while. It's really, you know, if people keep reading them, I get to keep writing them.
Yeah, I look forward to reading all of them. I've read the first four, and they're very entertaining. And at the end of each book, you cite the historical references, which I just love.
Yeah, I like being able to document all of that and recommend other books people can read. You know, it's something that I always did with my nonfiction books. It's sort of expected. And it hadn't really occurred to me that, like, oh, people don't really do this with novels. But I decided to do it anyway. I think it's important. I think it helps.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today, Amy. It has been delightful again to speak with you.
Oh, thank you so much.
You have been listening to Through the Eyes of Women. I'm Kathleen Marshall, and my guest today was the delightful Amy Stewart, talking about her fourth book in the Cop Sister series, Miss Cop Just Won't Quit, and about the development of her Cop Sister series for viewing by Amazon. Signed copies of Miss Cop Just Won't Quit are available at Eureka Books in Eureka, California. As host, engineer, and editor of today's show, I would like to thank the rest of the Through the Eyes of Women team. To listen to this show again, go to khsu.org and look for it in the archives, or find it in the Through the Eyes of Women's permanent blog archives at khsuwomen.wordpress.com. Through the Eyes of Women is produced for KHSU, located at Humboldt State University. Tune in to Through the Eyes of Women every Monday afternoon at 1:30 right here on KHSU 90.5.